Okay, so I'm here with Molly Crabapple, who is most recently the author of The Art of Molly Crabapple, Volume 1, Week in Hell. Molly, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I just got back from my daily walk, and I've drunk lots of coffee, and life is good.
Oh, daily walk. How many miles do you generally do every day?
I guess it's not that. It's not hardcore like you are. It's like to McNally Jackson backs, like 3 miles.
Oh, 3 miles. That's pretty good. Plus, you get a book on the way. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I wanted to actually ask you about the logistics of this Week in Hell experiment. The first thing I have to say, in seeing the television covered up and in seeing the thermostat in the wall, what negotiations were there with the hotel management to actually allow this to happen?
Oh, we didn't ask the hotel to do it.
They found out while it was happening?
They didn't find out at all. This was entirely
really?
Surreptitiously. I'm going to probably send them a copy of the book.
Wow.
The reason was we initially wanted to do it at another hotel, and we had all this money from the Kickstarter, and we were like, golly, mister, here's $4,500 to do our crazy art project. And they were like, oh no, you must speak with our creative directors to see if you're in line with our creative vision. And I thought that was bullshit, so I just dressed up like a fancy person, borrowed a Ralph Lauren suitcase to hide all those rolls of paper in, and we...
Really?
Yeah.
It's like a bank heist.
We totally ran it like a bank heist. Wow. Snuck everything in, told the maid not to come all week, and...
Was that the 57 minutes that you spent eluding the maid that you referred to?
Yes, exactly.
Oh god, wow. Wow, so you actually had to plan this like a bank heist. I mean, I understand. I've done some of these interviews in hotels, and I'm told I can't actually go ahead and sit down with these microphones with another person and just have a conversation. So, why did you have to go ahead and do this almost like, you know, you were shooting without a film permit? What steps did you take to plan this bank heist?
So, me and Melissa, who's my amazing assistant, who is actually, like, the brains behind all of my harebrained ideas, we made a long list of everything that could possibly go wrong. We did everything from testing the right type of tape to hold the paper up that wouldn't peel off the paint, getting, like, the right fancy people suitcases so we wouldn't look, you know, all sketchy sneaking into the Gramercy Park Hotel with duffel bags.
Did you have any consultants saying, hey, you actually look professional enough to pass muster with the scrupulous guards?
What was so funny was I had this whole outfit, which could only be described as rich people's whore. It was like all Alexander McQueen and Louboutins and shit.
Yeah.
And I went in and everyone was wearing sweatpants and I was so disappointed.
Well, these tests about not peeling the paint off of the wall and actually the paper itself and the specific markers you used, I'm wondering, you know, what were the logistics here? I'm really curious.
The paper and markers?
Yeah, I mean, how many types of paper do you have to go through?
We didn't go through types of paper because I got that sponsored.
Okay.
It was more, Melissa's whole wall was covered with different strands of paper being held up with different types of tape.
Yeah, wow, fantastic. What other logistics were needed aside from this? I mean, you know, anything else that you're missing?
We had tons and tons of friends sneaking in the entire week, and we found a back staircase for them to sneak up.
Wow.
Because we didn't, especially when we had the wild closing party.
This is like Philip Petit walking across the World Trade Center, how he had friends gradually get all the supplies going up over the course of several weeks in advance. Was it similar to here?
It was kind of like that. I even had one of my friends go into the hotel looking super sketchy so that he could see how much scrutiny he would get.
Oh, really? What? Did you have any kind of input into his skeeziness?
No, we just went with his natural dress.
Oh, I see. I got it. Now, many of the visitors who came into this hotel room during this week, I'm wondering if you asked permission to draw them. I mean, this raises an interesting question for me because you have one particular drawing that's part of this elaborate project where you have the photographers who were drawn like lizards to your friend because they're ogling her with their cameras. And so I'm wondering, and this lady made me think, you know, how much is any artist who illustrates or sketches or paints different from, say, a photographer of any stripe? You know, what are your thoughts on this? And what are your thoughts in terms of, you know, drawing people at will who happen to come into the room? Or was that the agreement for anyone who came through the room?
Well, people usually want to be drawn by me,
sure.
But that's actually an awesome question. I've always thought that the instinct of the photographer and the visual artist are very similar in that we're generally twitchy weirdos who want to hang out with the cool people, and we use our camera or our sketch pad as a way to kind of bribe the cool people to hang out with us. But the thing is that photography has become so ubiquitous that people don't feel impressed anymore by having their picture taken. And in fact, it can become, like, really grabby and soul-stealing.
Yeah.
Like, I used to march a lot at the Mermaid Day Parade, and sometimes there would be such a crush of photographers, like, yelling at you how to pose and demanding that you arch your back this way or, you know, demanding that you look at them, that it wasn't a fun thing at all. Whereas most people only get drawn a few times in their life, so it still has a novelty to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always kind of used my sketchpad as this key to sneak into scenes where I really didn't belong.
But stealing another person's soul, it seems to me that you've always been very conscious about this, even from the Dr. Sketchy stuff. So my question is how do we return the balance so that the person who is photographed or the person who is drawn actually feels comfortable and doesn't feel as if they have their soul stolen by through the process of art?
Well, with me, what I always try to do is I always try to capture the person's personality as well as just how hot they look.
Yeah.
Like when I did the picture of Stoya on that door, I'm talking to her and I do like her beautiful, beautiful, perfect, like mathematically perfect face. Then I also, since I'm friends with her, I draw her making her own costumes. She's a brilliant costumer and on her aerial hoop. And then I talk to her and she complains about obnoxious photographers. And so I draw them swarming around her.
So much of the input came from what she was telling you as you were actually drawing her.
Exactly. It was just as much a portrait of our conversation.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of the hoop, that was based off of memory, or did you have any source material for that? Or
that was based off of memory. I've seen a lot of aerialists in my time.
Yeah. You note that you were drawing the top of the wall at the very beginning of this so that you would have some inspiration for your dreams. And it seems to be between that and the influx of stories that you had plenty of inspiration. This leads me to ask, well, what do you do if you run out of ideas to sketch during this situation?
I asked the internet. I had a live stream going a lot, and my live stream audience would be saying, draw hippos on the moon, draw undersea Algonquin round table, and I would put that in if I was running out of inspiration.
Yeah. So did you feel that sometimes the list of suggestions was too intrusive a presence, or there were a lot of bad ideas sifting through this? Were you playing beat the clock because you had only a week to cover this entire surface?
There was a certain amount of beat the clock going on. I drew pretty much every waking hour. Like the in the back of all my glamorous friends partying, there was usually like me standing up on top of a shelf frantically sketching things.
Really? So, I mean, were there any trial runs of you sketching things, like say in your bathroom for like half a day or anything like that?
I was at Stumptown Comics Festival. They had me as a guest and I didn't want to sit behind a table and sign things because I don't know, I felt like I was at a craft fair or something. So instead I was like, why don't you just hang up a giant piece of paper where my table would be and I'll just draw on it over the course of the convention, and I did a 6-foot by 6-foot drawing.
So that was the trial run.
That was where I got the idea.
Were there any other runs before that? Maybe 3 by 3?
that's just my career.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, what do you need often to keep your routine sort of changed up? I mean, you know, you sort of suggested that this was the end of a particular period in your life. It was sort of your renouncement of pen and ink. You know, how often do you need to change things up in order to stay fresh as an artist? I'm curious. What do you anticipate the next move? How does it come organically? You just do it and just sort of becomes ambitious by default? Or?
I'm not a very thoughtful person. Yeah. I am incapable of thinking in 5-year plans. And also I'm kind of young, so I don't really know. Like I just don't have that many periods in my work. I don't know. I was in this kind of like deep fucked up, like almost clinical depression when I was, you know, when I was 27, and I don't know why. My brain was just wonky. And I needed to do something to kind of do violence to all of the stuff in my art that I was tired of, and this was how I did it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'll need to do it again, but I don't know when or how.
Yeah, sure. Before we rolled tape, you were alluding that you were not so good in certain areas, but I would argue that maybe that actually might be a blessing, having these great vast valleys to go ahead and plant some seeds in. So I'm wondering if you can talk about how this affects you as an artist. Like, you know, I peeked at your Twitter feed and noticed that you were reading Sontag and all that. So my question to you is, does being deficient in one area actually, is it of benefit in knowing that you're not good at a certain area? I mean, how does this make you feel? How does this affect your art?
Well, I think it's really interesting what education people get as a birthright and then what they get as an adult. There's a scene in Bonfire of the Vanities where Sheldon's mistress, who grows up poor, is sort of shamed at a party because she didn't know who Christopher Marlowe was.
Yeah.
Not that she hadn't read him, but that she didn't know he was a playwright.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of class thing where, like, what basic information do you get from where you come from? And sometimes I think it's an advantage to have certain parts of your brain fresh because the stuff triggers new things in you. It's not just this thing that you get introduced to in a dreary educational setting. It's something that you get introduced to out of passion and love and need.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of that moment, I mean, I've been having this discussion. Dick Clark recently died, and there were people who were out of retribution, basically shaming those who were on Twitter saying, who is Dick Clark? And I felt myself conflicted with this, because on one hand, I'm like, oh, well, come on, you could totally look this up. On another hand, as you say, do we need to entirely mock someone because they don't know something? I mean, is this indicative of our client? What do we do about this? Or is it just a matter of just making things fun?
I mean, I think that we're at this weird historical moment where the amount of knowledge available to know is practically infinite. Yeah. Like, you could learn about anything on Wikipedia. You can learn about anything online. It's so easy to be a Johnny-come-lately that I think shaming someone because their knowledge base is in one area rather than in, I don't know, old school pop culture is kind of weak and stupid to me.
Sure, sure. Actually, the accordion player who crops up at the very beginning of this Week in Hell project, what benefit does an accordion player have on your art?
I like performers around me. I'm a crap performer myself. I tried to do it. I was dreadful. And performers have always had this, like, almost like sacred, how do I put this? They're alchemical to me. They take all this really hard, brutal work and all this incredibly unglamorous schlepping, and then for like 3 minutes, they become a god. So I just like to have performers around me. Jason Savvy, the accordion player, is an old buddy of mine, and I like his music. It's inspiring. I got to draw him on the wall.
How often have you had musical performers there as you were, you know, working on something artistically? I mean, how often does this happen with you? Aside, of course, the burlesque dancers and all that stuff.
Well, one of my best friends in the entire friggin' world is Kim Bookbinder, who is a rock musician, and me and her have collaborated on a million things. Whenever she is in New York, I drag her over to my place and we drink lots of absinthe and she plays me old Union songs and I draw. So I love musicians. I always like to use my art to get my dorky presents into their golden shining ones.
Do you think performers give you something that, say, other things do not in terms of inspiration for art?
God, yes, performers inspire me. They're kind of the entire basis of my work. The New York underground performance scene is like my spiritual family.
Yes, yes. Let's talk about the girl things. The many faceless figures with parasols who are going along tentacles balancing on the platform above the top part of the doors. Did you consider soliciting the internet at any point for faces for these people, or were they pretty much hardcore faceless girl things from the get-go?
So, the evolution of the girl thing, I initially started drawing those when I was 16 to sign love letters to my boyfriend.
Yes.
And the reason I didn't do faces on them is because they were like half an inch big.
Yes.
And ever since then, they've become my kind of stand-in that runs around doing mischief and mocking the main action of the pieces. I don't want to do faces on them. I feel like having something without a face makes it more universal, and if I put a face on it, then people will be like, that doesn't look like me.
Yeah. Well, also, I want to ask you as well about your tendency towards the curved line. I mean, one of the moments I like in Scarlet Takes Manhattan quite a bit is when the curls of Scarlet actually end up transforming into the curls of fire that are around her. And also, with the girl things, it's all about the curves, lots of bells and so forth. And so, why do you think that the curved line has appealed to you more than the straight line, which is, I think, a theoretical question, but it does seem to be there in droves throughout your work.
I feel like the curved line is my handwriting. It's what my wrist does when I draw. It's so fundamental and implicit to how I make things that I don't think that it was a conscious choice at all. I just think that's how my hand works.
Yeah. So, well, some artists gravitate towards straight lines. Any ideas on why it was curved for you? Or?
Well, when I draw, my line is really hesitant and tentative and sketchy, and I make like a million of them. And I don't know. I just think it's my hands are small and messed up, and they just make curvy shapes.
Sure. The Undersea Algonquin Roundtable that you were mentioning earlier, this actually has this sort of portly Mad Hatter type who has this hat above the helmet and all that, and he has sharper edges than a lot of the other figures there. And I was thinking to myself, why is this guy more dominant than the sort of the possible Dorothy Parker person who's right behind him? What of this big, massive person? Was this sort of...
It was Wolcott. It was Alexander Wolcott.
Oh, well, yeah, exactly. There you go. But also, like, you know, in terms of the spirit of revolution and the Arab Spring, I know that was also an inspiration. Did you find that some of the news headlines, some of the political developments were of greater inspiration than, say, the dreams that were above your head? Or was it just pretty much an all-purpose intake of possible artistic directions?
So I started with the bedroom, which was this really personal room where I did undersea Algonquin round tables, and I did pictures of me and my best friend having a pity party and all sorts of, you know, personal wank. And then in the other room, I did a 20-foot mural that was sort of reflective of the news. I had a squid eating books that was my WikiLeaks squid. I had this sort of pug dog statue that represented Gaddafi being toppled.
Squid eating books. Which squid eating books did you consult?
Which squid eating books did I consult?
I'm curious, yes. How many squid eating books did you have at your disposal for this?
Oh, no, I'm being ungrammatical. Oh, yeah, it's a squid in the act of eating books.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. But anyway, you're going on about these other...
So I did all of these, all of sort of the world events of the time as represented by crazy statues and animals and funny hats and girl things up to no good. Mm-hmm. And then a week after I got out of the hotel room, Occupy Wall Street hit.
Yeah, I know. Your timing was just a... But the pigs there were plenty of pigs as well throughout the actual walls, and they seemed to crop up as well. I mean, was that... part of me was thinking Animal Farm. It was interesting that you decided to make the clients pigs. Was that kind of part of the conversation as well?
With Dante?
Yes.
So I've been working for a long time with this nightclub called The Box, which is one of the swankiest, most gorgeously produced, most depraved nightclubs in the world, where they sell bottles of champagne for $20,000.
Yeah.
And I've always drawn their clients as pigs, because they are. And my sort of pigs, which they're loving pigs, I like to think. Like, they're very cute and rounded and big-eyed, have always been my sort of stand-in for the I don't know, banker at play.
Yeah. What was the first animal that you ever drew?
Oh, fuck's sake. The first animal I ever drew...
Or the first types of animals that you were drawn to, I'm curious.
Oh my god, my memory is so deficient.
That's okay.
I feel like the animals that I keep drawing over and over again are kind of animals that lend themselves to swirlies, like elephants and octopi.
Yeah, got it. Octopi, well, of course we have the squid, but elephants, you know, is it really just the tail and the tentacles that tend to jazz you here?
They're just kind of grotesque but comical. I like animals that are grotesque and have a pathos to them. That's why I like dogs with faces smushed in by God and anglerfish. I think drawing grotesque things is way more interesting than drawing smooth, sleek, pretty things.
Huh. What about realism? Does the grotesque qualities of some of what you pursue allow you to get at some... you know, some effort to depict reality, some effort to respond to the Arab Spring, some effort, and also we haven't even mentioned the pity party, which I quite like, which actually has a little moment of hope there with some of the girl things, with the balloons, as well as the balancing wire. So it's like, well, you know, despite the fact that these figures have these really beaked triangular noses, there is also this possibility that, well, if they go ahead and turn their head around, they might actually see the girl thing and say, okay, well, maybe I could grab a balloon and actually have a better day.
As opposed to just sitting here
sulking. Sitting there sulking and all that, yeah.
That was, me and Kim thought of the pity party because we would have this terrible tendency just to like sit around drinking and bitch about people more successful than us and talk about how our noses were big and our tits were sagging and life sucked.
You still bitch about people who are more successful than you? You're quite a
Everyone
success.
Everyone in the entire world bitches about that. I'm sure fucking Napoleon was bitching that he wasn't Ramses.
Yes, or he didn't have a big enough tricorn. There's an ultimate pity party image for the nose. Well, I mean, how much does despair or dwelling upon the self like this in this sort of temporary solipsistic state, how much does this inspire you as an artist? How much do you draw from this when you're working on something?
How much do I draw from...
From, like, sort of despair and self-pity and these sorts of negative emotions and so forth.
Well, one of the weird things is being depressed is really inspiring to me, and that's, like, a terrible thing to admit because I don't want to glamorize it and be like... Hey kids, if you're really fucking miserable, you're gonna make cool art. It's not like that, but for me it works.
Well, there's scientific backing. Kay Renfield Jamison wrote a book on this.
Really, I didn't know this.
Art and depression. Yeah, it's really good. Actually, she also did a memoir called An Unquiet Mind, which I think you would dig.
Oh please, God, loan this to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But so there's just something chemical that being depressed does to my brain, where I'm just like, I don't want to look at the outside world. The only true world is the square of paper. You know, I'm just gonna deal with it all day, so I don't have to deal with myself. And then a lot of my other sort of lighter drawings come from a chip on my shoulder snideness.
Like, such as what?
Well, one time this famous artist wrote a really mean letter to me. I mean, not a famous artist, but a very successful artist wrote a really mean letter to me. And so I drew this picture called, a portrait of him called the Prancing Dancing Jackass.
Really? And it allowed you to sort of, I guess, level out the...
Exactly. So usually when I don't like someone or when I don't like something, I make like a mean little straw man of them in my sketchbook.
Do you feel bad after you have drawn such a... No, not at all.
Oh, fuck no, not at all.
Yeah. Well, you don't see with resentment towards figures such as this artist.
No, I mean, it's just that it doesn't hurt anyone, and you're making something other people might be able to get joy out of.
Oh, yeah, I did want to sort of ask you, you know, what happens when you get stuck? I mean, do you ever get stuck when you're working on your art where you don't know where you're going to go with it? I mean, what do you do to complete it? Or do you just sort of keep at it and keep working at it until you actually do have something? Both in terms of the wall of hell and something else you might be doing.
Well, I know what I want my work to look like when it's done. By this point, I've drawn, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of things, and I know what a completed Molly Crabapple piece looks like. I know the exact, like, type of swirly lines and the sort of level of finish to it. So I usually know how to, like, soldier on to that point, or else I know when the piece is going to be such crap that I just have to shelve it because it's never going to get to that point.
Yeah.
In terms of my larger practice, I'm just a workaholic. I just work all day. I don't think about it too much. When I'm not inspired, I just draw my hand or I do stuff for money.
What about, you know, what's your downtime like? Is it just absinthe and friends or what?
Downtime, ha ha ha. I don't have much downtime. I'm either drawing all day or I'm taking my like little walk to my bookstore or I'm reading. But almost always I'm either drawing or attending to some aspect of sort of the business of running my art company.
Yeah, yeah. What do you do to prevent yourself from repeating yourself? Do you worry about that at all? Or?
I think if you're a commercially successful artist, you have to repeat yourself because people want to buy products that they've already known.
Yeah.
I think that most commercial artists, whether they admit it or not, are actually forcing themselves to repeat themselves.
Yeah. But what do you do to prevent yourself from falling into some sort of Damien Hirst-like trap? I mean, have you thought about this? Are there certain things you will not do? Are there certain clients who you will not take on to prevent yourself from, you know, succumbing to some unethical business practice? What's the maximum you would do, hypothetically, in order to sort of collaborate with a corporate client or whatnot?
Well, I obviously do collaborate with corporations, but I remember there was this one company that did, like, they did these really cool kind of sponsored art projects, and they came to me and they wanted to do something with me, and they were like, but some of the corporations are kind of sketch. And I'm like, what do you mean sketch? I'd work with a tobacco company. If people want to give themselves cancer, fine. And they're like, no, not tobacco, BP.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I can't do that, man.
So there are some people who you will say no to.
Yeah, I'd work with alcohol and tobacco companies, but I wouldn't work with Big Pharma or Bank of America.
Huh. Someone might argue, the moralist might say, well, if you work with an alcohol or a tobacco company, they're killing people with their particular products, especially with tobacco. So, you know, what makes that different from, say, Big Pharma or Bank of America?
I feel like tobacco companies only kill people who are complicit in it, whereas BP spills their oil everywhere to people who have nothing to do with them, and Bank of America destroys the whole world economy.
Did you set any ground rules when you first started off as a sort of successful artist, or when you actually had established a business and so forth, of, you know, things you just would not do, and have those boundaries changed at all during the last couple of years?
At the start, I had no rules. I was just really desperate. I made so little money, and I was working as like a really low rent naked model, and I hated it so bad. And I would do anything. I mean, the sketchiest thing I ever did is I did a really mean portrait of Hillary Clinton topless for a conservative book cover.
Wow.
And
really?
I totally regret doing that.
Really? I did not know this.
Oh God. And what's particularly galling about it is I actually think I did a good job of doing such a horrible thing.
Wow. Wow. So there have been these points of ethical lines that you've been examining all along.
That was
at a point of financial desperation?
Yes. At that point, I was making like $1,000 a month, and this person gave me $600, which is pitiful, and I was like, well, what the fuck has Hillary Clinton ever done for me?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I mean, I wanted to also ask, I mean, you know, how do you keep your art absolutely pure and uncompromising when there is such commercialism attached when you need to survive, when you need to keep the business flourishing, when you need to keep your assistants hired, when you need to ensure that clients keep coming back to you for work. I mean, do you feel that you have a fair enough balance to just do absolutely sui generis crabapple work while also, you know, having to go ahead and do, say, a Red Bull thing or whatnot? Or do you sort of see no lines between the artistic and the commercial?
I mean, I think that people contain multitudes. I think that you can do work that is like your like pure, holy, golden, you know, soul of souls work,
yeah,
and also just churn out the work that you're known for clients. I think that it's a very, very rare person who's able to do only the work that's in their heart of hearts to make a living. And I think that if you do only do the work that's in your heart of hearts, eventually you start whoring out your heart of hearts,
yeah,
and just repeating yourself. I also don't really give much truck to the idea of purity in terms of people. Purity is for characters in novels who have a single point. People are messy and hungry and have all sorts of things in them.
There's no Rorkian temperament that could possibly allow itself onto the New York art scene.
I think that the concept of Howard Roark and the whole like Randian ideal, people act like it's a fantasy for sociopaths.
Yeah.
It's actually a fantasy for artists. The idea is that you are so good that your first draft is always right. Everyone who doesn't like your first draft is like a sniveling little fat man who is evil on the inside. And eventually all the cool kids will think that your first draft is the shit and give you lots of money. That's what Ayn is saying. And I think that's very resonant to a lot of artists, but it's just artist wank material.
On the other hand, and I'm going to try to phrase this gently, I mean, you think you would be here if you had not done nude modeling work in this position right now?
No. And the reason is not because I think nude modeling made me famous or anything like that, because that is a very temporary and fleeting fame and it has its downsides. The reason is that a lot of the things that I did early in my career, like working for the New York Times, I got because I was able to do fairly expensive promotional campaigns, like sending out, you know, mailings of postcards to art directors.
Yeah.
And I was able to afford those because I was making $100 an hour. In no way do I think that if I was working a minimum wage retail job, I would have been able to afford, like, a scanner, you know, all these things that, you know, all these sort of outlays that you have to do to be an artist.
Yeah. Then what of, say, you know, someone who couldn't go into nude modeling? I mean, how would they actually be able to survive or launch an artistic business? Do you have any advice for them by chance? Or?
A lot of guys that I know, like my boyfriend, they worked sort of like construction industry jobs, which pay more than, you know, the usual shit retail.
Yeah.
I knew a girl who launched her career by selling her eggs so that she had $10,000.
Yeah.
I think that the world is incredibly, incredibly slotted against people without money, and that you need to kind of do whatever you can to break out of that. But I think that, you know, getting a retail job and working hard is a very hard thing to do, you know, and succeed at before you burn out.
Yeah. There's also one other angle to this New York art idea, which I wanted to actually ask you about. Do you think that New York is hostile, needlessly hostile, to certain strains of art? Like, I mean, I think, for example, of a wonderful photographer like Zoe Strauss in Philadelphia, who is doing something that I think, quite possibly, is a form of art that Philadelphia alone could only actually create, you know, because of the conditions there, because she's also chronicling the city, she's responding to the city. Do you think that New York is just not as particularly reflective of, say, a Zoe Strauss-like figure, or not allowing a certain type of artist to survive here? Or do you think that this city contains enough multitudes with which to allow all sorts of artists?
Well, I don't know Zoe Strauss's work, yeah, so it's hard for me to comment on that.
Any sort of artist that was particular to a city or another place besides New York, let's just say.
I mean, I think all cities have their own spirit, and I think that, you know, New Orleans creates a certain sort of artist, or Sao Paulo creates a certain sort of artist. I'm from New York, so it's very difficult for me to get into this mindset that a lot of people have, that the city is so brutal.
Yeah.
Because to me, New York's just the way that things are, and everywhere else is too slack.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that if you do giant sculptures, New York is probably going to be hard for you, yeah, because space is really tight.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, actually, I wanted to ask you, because you have alluded to some nameless editor at the New York Times Book Review saying that, well, you can't work here because you're not an intelligent artist. Was this Sam Tannenhaus who said this?
No, or? It was not, and I'm not saying his name.
Okay. Why do you think that there was such...
Honestly, my work was stupid. Like, yeah, sometimes, you know, you think you're, like, really hot shit when you're 21,
yeah.
And then 7 years later, you look at that and you're like, oh, God, no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean... How have you tailored your work over the years to woo a potential client? I mean, do you do a lot of that, or do people mostly come to you these days?
I don't try to woo clients at all. People just come to me. I have a really weird style that's not the most commercial, but a lot of people like it, and when they do, they pay me money for it.
There is also one thing. I noticed that a certain character named Luke Sont appears from the New York Times in Scarlet Takes Manhattan. And I know that you had read Low Life at that time, and I was wondering if you had met Luke... you know, before you had actually included Luke, the character, in the book, or whether this was just sort of your kind of homage back to him, like, hey, man, you just really helped me out. And I'm fairly certain you've probably met Luke since.
I met Luke once, very briefly, at a party. Yeah. He's one of my favorite writers. I just was so totally blown away by Low Life that I did a bunch of internet hunting, and I tracked down his email, and I was like, please, 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 can I draw you into my comic?
You got his permission then.
Yeah, and I sent it to him, and I hope he likes it.
Sure. Has research ever bogged you down as an artist? Has there been a situation where you've just had too much of it, and you kind of have to let things go? How do you balance that?
I guess that's an interesting question. I think that I'm doing the most research on my current project, Shell Game, that I've ever done on any project, and... with Shell Game, I'm trying to take really big themes like the Egyptian Revolution or like hacktivists and distill them into these crazy sort of theatrical, surrealist, allegorical things. And in doing that, obviously, I can't get everything, but I do try to talk to people a lot, and I do try to do a lot of research. When I did my piece, The Hive Mind, about Anonymous, that was probably my most researched one, because I really wanted to get it right, because those guys don't fuck around. Like, if you're, you know, you can't be an idiot dealing with Anonymous.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have to ask you about Amber Ray's lipstick, which, from what I can tell, is the only non-pen and ink intervention on the wall. you know, I'm wondering, you know, why did she get the lipstick treatment, and why didn't anybody else?
She didn't ask me. She just did it.
She just did it. Oh, I see. So, did you consider maybe other lipstick marks along the lines, or?
It looked so beautiful. It was just this single red splotch. But yeah, she just went up to it and kissed her own lips.
Well, Molly, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
It was so awesome chatting with you.